From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, animal communications. Should be fun. Here's what's happening. Well, they say the United States is on the verge of yet another depressing pandemic milestone, 800,000 deaths. It's a sad plunge in a year that is ending the heartbreak for many grieving families trying to navigate the holiday season. On behalf of everybody here at Coast to Coast, to those of you who have lost someone because of COVID-19 or any other illness, our deepest condolences. A federal judge in the Southern District of New York has denied a motion from New York City's public school employees for a preliminary injunction against COVID-19 mandates on the basis of religious exemption. The district judge ruled that because the plaintiffs have not shown irreparable harm or a likelihood of success on the merits, their motion for a preliminary injunction is denied, according to the ruling. As the coronavirus pandemic nears the end of its second year, a new survey finds the global health crisis is taking a concerning toll on the mental health of most American adults. In fact, just 42% feel optimistic about post-pandemic life, while most saying that the new normal of fearing viruses and overwhelming stress is impacting their well-being. Results show that 2 in 3 American adults say the pandemic continues to affect at least one aspect of their health and well-being. And the number is even higher among women, 70%, and young adults, 75%. The Senate has voted to lift a federal debt ceiling by $2.5 trillion, clearing a key hurdle toward avoiding a U.S. default after months of discord on Capitol Hill. The vote was pretty much along party lines. Investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz with us live from Europe. Catherine, are we ever going to get our financial mess straightened out?
Well, not if we keep, you know, it's a little bit like animal health. If you keep behaving that way, you're going to keep having problems.
That's true.
So it doesn't have to be this way, George. But, the reality is there's $21 trillion missing from U.S. accounts. The U.S. federal government has refused to comply with the laws related to audited financial statements or, you know, all sorts of financial management. They've been running secret books. And frankly, if you look at the amount of money going out the back door, it's very significant. And now, you know, what I've been saying for 20 years is if we keep doing this, you know, if you rob the bank will have no money. Now, the solution has been to just print money. And of course, that's triggering inflation and the debt problem. So we've been levering up the house, pulling the money out the back door. And now we're at the point where both the debt and the inflation are going to skyrocket. So what this is going to do is, you know, you're going to hit the victim twice. You've stolen their money out the back door, and now you're going to print their assets away.
Absolutely.
So there's a reason we have all these, you know, the financial people, the way the central bankers are going to protect themselves from being accused of stealing all the money is by essentially health repression. And, you know, I hate to say this, but the all of the restrictions going on have nothing to do with health. They all have to do with managing a situation where you've stolen people's money and you don't want to tell them.
I was going to say, Catherine, the situation in Europe with the COVID-19, quote unquote, seems to be unbearable. What's going on out there?
Well, I can't, you know, I'm in a relatively rural area. So I think the rural areas are simply just going about their business. But what you're looking at is the same kind of restrictions broadly that are everywhere in the world, which is limitations on travel, limitation on activities, and very invasive health mandates, which are not based in science and are not good for our health. We just finished doing a very detailed survey, and what we discovered is that all the mandates and restrictions are far more harmful to people's health than anything going on with a virus.
All right, so, Catherine, have yourself a great Christmas. And she is live in Europe. There's a little delay out there. Catherine Austin Fitz. You know, talking politics during the holidays can turn family gatherings into hostile debates very fast. Have you noticed that lately? While most people eventually forgive and forget these political disagreements, There is a point of no return where Americans can no longer coexist with each other. A new study by researchers at Cornell University finds there may be an actual tipping point where no issue imaginable can unite anybody. Strange times. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, things are getting hot, huh?
Well, you know, I feel exactly the opposite of that, you know, with the study, you know, saying basically that people can't agree on anything. Well, you just reported today that they agreed on a debt ceiling. So when they want to agree, Democrats and Republicans, they cross the aisle and they get together and they do it. Now, you know, we have a lot of major disagreements. And one of the things that's happened in the country, this polarization that they're talking about, is that we have groups right now, factions in the United States, that are overly represented in the body politic. In other words, the issues that are driven in Washington right now, just like in pop culture, are driven by a very small group of factions. And I'm not going to name the factions, but I think we all know what those factions are. And for that reason, we have this kind of ongoing disagreement between Republicans and Democrats, because the mainstream, which is really the vast majority of people in this country, are in sync with each other on most issues. They don't want inflation. They want low gas prices. They want secure borders. They want security, for their families. They don't want looting. They don't want rioting. They don't want to see the lunatic fringe start bashing windows in our Capitol or our White House. We are the majority of people, George, are reasonable people. There is no, what that study is like a microanalysis, basically, that, you know, talks about tipping points and this kind of thing related to being able to get along. But the reality is we, the majority of Americans, are reasonable people. We don't believe in racism. The country is not systemically racist. We agree that meritocracy, people should be allowed to work hard in this country from whatever walk of life you come from whatever country you come from, and play by the rules, and you can make it big. So I think we need more diversity, more of opinion. We cannot have a media that's been corrupted by one political party and simply expect that we're going to have vast agreement. You have to have a broad consensus on essential principles, and I think we've got to get back to basic civics and principles of American democracy. And if we do that, I think we'll get along a lot better.
Now I know why you beat Howard Bloom by, 80 points? Thanks, John. Dr. John Curtis. The twilight zone between sleep and wakefulness may be a creative sweet spot, according to new research. Published this month in the journal Science Advances, sleep researchers in Paris found that spending at least 15 seconds in the first stage of sleep, that's it, or non-rapid eye movement, tripled creative problem solving. How about that? A Las Vegas man in considerable legal trouble following a wild incident where he breached an airport security perimeter by way of a limousine. Then he donned a clown mask while attempting to commandeer a jet for a trip to Area 51 to see aliens. Nobody got hurt. He gave himself up, but he's in deep trouble. We've got the full story in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Seth Shostak joins us next from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Looking forward to this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our dear friend Seth Shostak back, Senior Astronomer and Institute Fellow at SETI Institute, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, with degrees in physics and astronomy from Princeton University and Caltech. He has a long history of research in radio astronomy and in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI. Seth has written more than 600 popular articles, at least, on science and technology, hosts a weekly radio show on science and podcasting as well. And Seth, I'll always remember getting a hold of you during my early St. Louis days when you were at Arecibo. How are you?
Just fine, George. Yes, I remember those as well. That was kind of a real pleasurable break from our observing down there.
Is Arecibo now completely finished? Is it done, or are they trying to regroup it?
Fix it. I haven't seen anything about it, to be honest, in at least a month or something like that. But they're thinking of what to do. There are various plans, but I don't think they're going to build that antenna again, lamentably.
Is that a huge void for us?
Well, I think it is. I mean, some people are moving to it, if you will, an improved successor, which is in China, which is even bigger than the Arecibo telescope. The Arecibo telescope was 300 meters across, about 1,000 feet across, and the one in China is 500 meters across. So, you know, that's, I don't know, 1,500 or 1,600 feet across. So it is bigger. And, you know, they will let you use it, but, you know, it's not an American telescope anymore. And I don't know whether I should worry about that or not, but anyhow, that's the situation.
Lots to talk with you about tonight, Seth, but update us on SETI. What's going on there?
Well, sit back, George. I can tell you what's going on in SETI because there's so much now. I mean, maybe that's the most remarkable thing about SETI is that, you know, it used to be a sort of a very small field. The total number of people working in the field was maybe 12, something like that, depended on when you asked that question. But that's not true anymore. SETI has become a much bigger enterprise. More people are being involved in radio SETI, which is the conventional SETI. You know, we use big antennas and try and pick up the aliens on the air. Well, you have the Breakthrough Listen program. That's the biggest one. And that's run out of the University of California at Berkeley. They use antennas, you know, from West Virginia to Australia, big radio telescopes that are typically a couple of hundred feet in size. And that's proceeding. Their goal is to look at 1 million star systems, something that they will probably accomplish by the, I don't know, 2030 or something. I don't really know. So that's the big one. But there's also the Serendip program. That's also out of the University of California, Berkeley. And they're using that big antenna in China. Now, if that isn't enough, there's a survey by the SETI Institute. Well, the SETI Institute, thanks to the generosity of a fellow by the name of Franklin Antonio, the SETI Institute is upgrading everything at the Allen Telescope Array here in California. And they're going to be on the air soon doing experiments that can't be done anywhere else. And that's just the radio part of it. I won't go on with this monologue here, but there are at least as many experiments looking for laser flashes, so optical SETI.
Has technology upped the odds that maybe you're going to find or hear something?
Well, put it this way. I mean, the experiments tend to be a little bit more sensitive than they used to be. I don't know that that'll make such a big difference. But what the big difference is, the application of faster computers to the whole thing, and even to some degree, machine learning, you know, a form of artificial intelligence, it's much quicker than it used to be. In other words, you say, okay, we're going to look at all the stars that are within, you know, 100 light years of Earth or whatever, and that's a lot of stars, right? That's tens of thousands of stars. If you can go through those stars more quickly, if you can, you know, observe them more quickly, which the computers make possible, then, you know, the chances that you'll find something within your lifetime kind of thing go way up, and that's what's happening.
1977, Ohio State University, the WOW signal. Anything since then?
Well, the WOW signal continues to enjoy great popularity. It's the signal everyone wants to love.
And tell us why it's called WOW.
Well, it's called WOW because Ohio State University had a big radio antenna there near the campus in Columbus, Ohio. And that antenna was being used for astronomy, but then it turned out that, well, it was not really au courant anymore. It wasn't really, you know, state of the art. So they decided, well, I'll tell you what we'll do with this. We'll just sort of lock it down in place and let the sky move across, well, the sky, as it does because of the rotation of the Earth. And we'll just let it look for signals, for SETI signals, if you will, signals from ET. So the way that happened, in 1977, there was a guy, Jerry Amon was his name. It was a guy who would come in every couple of days to where the telescope was. He'd go into the observing room, and there was a big line printer. You know, you and I probably remember line printers. That's what computers had as output. It was a giant printer and producing stacks of paper. And he would look through the paper to see if there was anything that had been picked up. And one day, he goes in there in 1977, and he sees a signal that's so strong, that's so obviously looking like an ET signal, that he writes, "Wow," next to it. That's why it became known as the Wow signal.
I love it. It's so good. But you think we'll ever get another one like that?
Well, I'll tell you, people have looked for the Wow signal, you know, many times. It's been looked for with really antennas around the world. There's a guy in Chicago who, you know, has made it sort of his, it's a Kyle celeb for the guy. He actually has looked using telescopes again around the world, trying to pick up the Wow signal again, and he hasn't. And even at Ohio State, they've looked for the Wow signal again. They look for it like 1 minute after the first time it was found. It hasn't been found a second time. So what can you say about it? Maybe it was ET, but maybe it was some sort of interference that they haven't figured out. If you can't find it again, you really can't, you know, demand the Nobel Prize for it.
So if the government has just announced again that they're going to form another group, another committee to investigate unidentified aerial phenomena, what do you think's going on there?
Well, look, it's in a sense, we've kind of seen this play before. At least that's my feeling about it, because people obviously aren't going to all remember, but back in the 1950s, the government got very interested in what were called UFOs, right? And they had several investigative teams to go in and try and figure out what these things were. Why? Well, because the Air Force doesn't want to be flying around if there's something else flying around. So they wanted to know what they were. Now, people have various opinions about those early studies. A lot of people said, well, you know, they came in thinking that we know these are not aliens, so they didn't find aliens. I don't know. That might be legitimate. It might not be. But this new effort, new initiatives, I think are largely driven by those videos that were leaked in 2017. You know?
Sure. The Tic Tacs.
Yeah, Tic Tac. And you know, they couldn't really just say, well, ignore it. And so they've set up new committees to look at this stuff.
It's pretty, and it's kind of dramatic, though, isn't it? When a government sets this, or are they just trying to appease us?
Well, I don't know. Listen, George, I have worked for the government. You know, I've worked for the Navy's research division and so forth and so on. And these people are, you know, the ones I met were never the kind that would say, let's just set this up as a sort of a sham. But it's also the case that last summer, you know, there was a report that was mandated by Congress from the Navy intelligence services and others in the Pentagon to address what we're seeing in those videos, for example. And what did that report say? Nada. It didn't say very much. It certainly didn't say they were aliens. It said we don't know what they are, and that's not very satisfactory.
Seth, I think it was the late Stephen Hawking who warned us to be very careful about signals we send out to try to alert extraterrestrials that we're here. Is that a concern?
Well, not to me, but it is to some people. And many of them are my friends, actually. They get quite emotional about all this. They think we should, you know, not broadcast anything to the sky. But the reason I don't get upset about it is because we're broadcasting to the sky anyway, right? I mean, the San Francisco airport is maybe 20 miles from where I'm sitting, and they've got radars, of course, to guide the planes in, particularly during bad weather. And those radars, those beams, you know, that radio signal, it's not a very interesting one, but that radio signal goes right out into space. So are we going to shut that down? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me to say we can't aim any, you know, antennas at the sky.
We're with Seth Shostak. He's with the SETI Institute. He's also an accomplished author. A couple of his books include Confessions of an Alien Hunter, Cosmic Company, Sharing the Universe, and Life in the Universe as well. The website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got his own and also the SETI Institute's website, which is SETI, SETI.org, or there's SethShostak.com, and we've got the link for you at coasttocoastam.com. Seth, this is just fascinating. How many years you've been doing this now?
You mean SETI work?
Yeah.
Well, I did an experiment with Jill Tarter, who is, you know, the woman that inspired the Ellie Arroway character in the movie Contact and the book. I did that experiment with her. I was working in Europe at the time, and she came to visit Europe, and we did an experiment in Holland. That was 1981.
You've been doing it for a long time. Let's talk more when we come back, and we'll take calls with you next hour. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Seth Shostak. We will take calls with Seth next hour here on Coast to Coast. What a fun job you have.
Well, I think you have a fun job too, George.
Well, I get to talk to you, which makes it even more fun.
Well, I don't know about that, but I don't want to discuss it because that wouldn't be fun.
Anyways, back to this committee that the government is going to reestablish. Would you like to be on that panel?
Well, of course I would. I mean, gosh, who wouldn't want to be on it? I have to say, I've testified a couple times to Congress about SETI and funding for SETI, and I guess I wasn't very effective because it hasn't really changed very substantially from the government's point of view. But I've also been—I was asked by Avi Loeb, and I think you may have had Avi on your program.
Avi's been on, yeah.
And to be on his science council, there are a lot of people who are sort of, giving a little bit of input. I'm among those. There's some other people who are doing some hard work trying to pursue his Galileo project. He wants to build equipment to look for, UAPs. And so, that gives me some insight into what's being done there.
And you're on that board, right?
Yes. Yes, I am. Yeah, they meet once a week. The people who are doing the really heavy lifting, right, are the people who are trying to design some equipment. And that's equipment that would, be able to see things that are unusual, to be able to sense them in the radio and infrared and, even audio, stuff like that. So it's, the ultimate in a surveillance instrument. The difficulty I think that they will have is that having one such instrument doesn't really do you much good, because you can only look around, maybe a distance of 10 miles in all directions. But that's still a very, very limited sample of what might be going on in our skies.
Seth, are our signals, ever since we started communicating with radio waves, could they have been picked up by ETs way out there in space?
Yeah, well, they could have. I mean, that was kind of the premise for, the story Contact, the novel and the book, and the movie, that, the aliens picked up the TV broadcast in 1936 in Berlin of the Berlin Olympics. Now, if you look at that carefully, you see that would never really work because the signal was so faint. There was very little power in that transmitter.
A lot of noise on it and grainy.
Well, yeah, but you couldn't even pick it up, even if you were in Berlin, if you weren't close to the antenna. So that wasn't really a very good signal. But ever since then, since the Second World War, we've had radar and we've had television, we've had FM radio, and those are all high-frequency transmissions that, as it turns out, just make it right through the atmosphere, the ionosphere of the Earth. They just go right into space. So if the aliens, had enough money to build a really big antenna farm, right, lots of antennas, maybe the size of the state of Vermont or something on that order, then they could at least see that, we've got television. And if they built a much bigger antenna than that, well, they could actually watch I Love Lucy if they found that was to their liking.
If there were alien craft circling the globe, could they be transmitting at the same time, too?
Yeah, well, they could be. I mean, this whole question, I take it that you're referring to the possibility of a probe in our solar system.
That they have sent this way.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, they sent this way. Now, that was an idea that didn't get a whole lot of traction in the past. But on the other hand, it's not impossible. And, it's now conceivable that we could make searches for that. The trouble is, you don't know where to look. The solar system's a big place, and the probe might not be any bigger than your car. I mean, who knows how big it is if there is one.
Right.
And, to try to find your car somewhere in the space of the solar system, that would be really tough. So it's certainly possible, but there's no evidence for it yet.
And look at the size of Sputnik in 1957. It was about as big as a basketball.
Exactly, yes. But on the other hand, it had a radio transmitter on it, and that helped. You really couldn't see it, or I couldn't see it, but I, you could pick it up on your shortwave radio, so that was kind of neat.
Now, you've talked about artifacts that could be discovered. Tell me what you think that could be.
Yeah, well, the whole idea behind artifacts is, you know, well, you look for signals. That's what SETI does. You look for radio signals. You look for flashing lasers. But, you know, you have to assume that those signals are getting to your antenna just at the time that, you know, you're looking for them. If the transmission stopped sometime when the dinosaurs were running around, you're not going to find anything. It's not that they aren't there, but for some reason they're not transmitting in this direction anymore. So if you look for something that the aliens may have built, then that's stuff that's always there. You can, you know, essentially always find it, just like I can find, I don't know, the skyscrapers in New York any day of the week. I don't have to wait for something special to find them. And even if humans disappeared tomorrow, I don't recommend that, but if that were to happen, you know, the skyscrapers would probably still be around, and you could still find evidence of our existence. So that's the idea of artifacts. Maybe aliens built something really big that we could see.
Why do we have this obsession with wanting to know whether we're alone or not in the universe?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And all I can say is, well, it's kind of nice to know, right? It's just curiosity. But really, you know, what was Charles Darwin doing back in the 1850s or whenever? I mean, he you know, what good was it to find that everything comes from something else, if you will, that we're all related because we're all DNA-based, and that humans are, you know, came out of the primate branch of the tree, if you will, of life. So, you know, that gives you some insight into how nature has worked when it comes to biology. And you could say, well, so what? But I think it was worth doing, very much worth doing. And in fact, it's essential in medicine these days. That's something else. But even aside from those practical benefits, science is about learning something new, you know, understanding how the universe works. And the fact that you might not see any practical benefit to that for a while, I don't think that, it's like writing music. What's the practical benefit?
If they're discovered, how close do you think they'll be to us?
Well, I don't know. But let's say that if you look at a million star systems, like the Breakthrough Listen project is trying to do, that you find something. So let's say that, you know, out of every million stars, there's one technological society. If that's the case, then the distance from here to the next civilization is on the order of a couple of hundred light years. So that's not very far. I mean, it's far if you're driving, but it's not so far.
What did the aliens say to Ellie in the movie Contact? Basically, that we're an interesting species and we're looking for life because we're so lonely or something like that?
Yeah. Loneliness is certain. I don't know that we're lonely, but, you know, that's an interesting aspect. Here's something else that you could argue. That and this idea actually was put forth by an AI researcher, Jeff Hawkins. He said, look, sooner or later, Homo sapiens is going to go away. I don't know that we'll be, you know, we'll self-destruct. That's obviously a possibility. But, you know, even if we don't, eventually all species are replaced by other species. So we're going to go away. And if we don't find the aliens, if you will, and tell them our story, right, just send some information about what Homo sapiens is like and has done, then you could say, well, you know, your day-to-day existence worrying about this, that, and the other, in the long run, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all because nobody will ever know. And I think it seems important to me that it's not all just, you know, totally useless and worthless. I would like that the story of Homo sapiens, you know, is carried on for at least a while.
I've asked you this before, but I always like asking you this. You believe there's extraterrestrial life out there, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing, but you don't believe we've been visited. How come?
Well, yes. I fear that my answer probably isn't going to interest you, George, because it isn't any different. I don't think they're here because, you know, while I'm part of this Galileo project, which is trying to find out if they're here, you know, I wish them the best of success, and they have some very competent people working there. But I think that if we were being visited, the evidence wouldn't be just, you know, the private possession of the government, that only the government would know that we're being visited. I think lots of people would know. The satellites that are looking down on the Earth 24/7, they would see some evidence, right? It wouldn't be something that just only a very small number of people would know about. It's that lack of, you know, confirmatory, corroborating evidence that makes me think, well, I don't think they're here.
And the one thing that grinds me is when they say, if SETI does find out that we're being visited or that we are getting signals, they're not going to tell us. That's wrong. I think you hold a news conference or you come on this show.
Oh, absolutely. No, the idea that we would keep that secret, gosh, you could say, oh, well, those guys are out of work now. Look, you know, nothing would guarantee our jobs more than to find some evidence that there actually is alien presence. And if it was close to Earth or in our atmosphere, okay, then it's there, and we'll start studying it there.
Would it surprise you, Seth, if and when we go to Mars with the humans, if they find artifacts, true artifacts, buildings, tools, something?
That would surprise me.
Yes, it would.
That would. In fact, if that happens, I'll buy you, you know, a cruddy dinner, because I just find that so implausible. Because if you have had a species on Mars that could do all that, you know, that species had to come from somewhere, from some other species on Mars. You would find evidence of, you know, ancient life all over Mars, just like you do on Earth, right? I mean, we didn't just sort of pop up here. There was a predecessor, and before that, another predecessor, and it goes back a couple hundred million years to a fish. And if you go farther back, it goes to bacteria. So there's this whole chain, and their remains and their current versions are visible all over the planet. So it doesn't seem very likely to me that you go to Mars and suddenly, boing, they have intelligent life.
Seth, what is a Dyson sphere?
Yeah, this was the idea of Freeman Dyson back in the 1960s, actually. And it's really a nifty thing. He just said, look, you know, if you're a civilization, a technological civilization, and you need more energy, instead of, you know, burning coal or, you know, natural gas or any of that stuff, or even nuclear power or wind power or solar power, what you do is you take apart some moon or planet that you're not using. In our solar system, there are plenty that we're not using. You just take it apart for the raw material, and you build, if you talk about a sphere, you build a giant sphere outside the orbit of the Earth, you know, maybe out close to Mars. And you coat the inside or cover the inside of this sphere with solar cells. So now you're collecting all the solar energy of the sun. This is really solar power on steroids. Right, so now you get 2 billion times more energy than the energy that's falling on the Earth. You beam that back to the Earth, and we have all the energy we can possibly use. And you don't have to make a complete sphere. In fact, you shouldn't make a complete sphere. So you make partial sphere. You just have fleets of solar panels in space. That's really what it is.
We're going to take calls next hour with Seth Shostak from SETI, so jump on board with a question or two. Give us your thoughts as well. It is fascinating. Now, the SETI array is located where?
Well, the Allen Telescope Array is northern part of California. Californians will know where Redding is.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Central Valley, and you go up I-5 to Redding, and you make a right turn. You go to the east about an hour and 20 minutes worth in the Cascade Mountains there, and that's where it is. And it's a pretty, you know, isolated place. Not because of any secrecy, but you just want to keep it away from people because people use a lot of electronic equipment, and that makes radio noise that interferes with what we're trying to do.
Explain the Frank Drake equation.
The Drake equation. Well, yes, the Drake equation was just an effort by Frank Drake, who did the first modern SETI experiment back in 1960. You know, that experiment didn't find ET, but people were very interested in it, and I think it was the National Academy of Sciences asked Frank, look, this could be a real thing, right, this SETI biz, so why don't you hold a meeting next year, 1961, hold a meeting, invite a dozen scientists, and talk about the probability that this will ever pay off. And Frank, you know, invited these people, and he needed an agenda for the meeting. So what he did was, when the meeting started, he just went to a blackboard and he just wrote this equation. And the equation was a way of estimating how many societies are out there in the galaxy that are broadcasting signals that are, you know, going through our bodies as we sit here. And, of course, that depends on how many stars have planets and
sure.
The direction those planets are good. And all these, there's seven terms there. And, you know, that's what it is. It's in every astronomy textbook. It's the second most famous equation in science.
And he's still with us. He's 91 years old.
He is, and he is. That's right. In fact, if you talk to Frank, you realize that, yeah, he may be 91, 92 now. But he's just as sharp as ever. He really is.
That's great. Well, you know, work probably keeps him going.
I think so.
Wouldn't that be amazing if we get a signal and he is around to be able to witness that?
I think that he would find that quite interesting. Actually, Carl Sagan said something in the last year of his life. He was asked, well, what do you feel bad about possibly missing? And the only thing I remember was he said, well, I regret the possibility that I may miss finding the first sign of aliens.
Wow. And he wrote the book Contact.
He did. 1983, I think. Yeah.
And he was a believer. Not that we were visited, but he was a believer they were out there, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. In fact, he was very optimistic about life in space. And you know, the thing I was going to say is that when we first began sending hardware to Mercury in the 19th Mercury, we didn't send hardware to Mercury. Well, we did, actually.
Yeah, we did.
To Mars, right? To Mars. The Mars Voyager project, which sent two landers.
Oh, and those landers were amazing. Seth, we'll come back and talk more and take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.